People say we're alike, Martin and I, but I'm not so sure. We look alike, and I suppose what our mutual friends might be picking up on is our shared tendency towards poking around in subjects no one else gives a damn about. We both like finding things out. Of the two of us, though, I believe Martin is the better human being. Martin cares about people, which is why he is so good at his job. When I tell him this, he always insists that I must care about people too, or I wouldn't put such time and effort into fighting their corners. Perhaps he's right, but I still think what I enjoy most about my work is the thrill of argument, the abstract battle of opposing forces. If doing good happens to be a side effect of that, I'm not going to knock it, but it isn't the driving force behind what I do. I don't think so, anyway. You'd better ask Martin. I hope he meets someone else. He's borne up remarkably well since Miranda died. But that's Martin all over, never one to make a fuss. I was always the one who made a fuss, getting cancer, then going crazy, then marrying Ray. Martin was there for me through all of it, no matter how much I managed to screw up. He can cook a mean curry, too. Have you ever heard of a watchmaker called Owen Andrews? I asked him once we'd finished eating. I poured us both another glass of wine. It was odd, the way his face changed. A lot of people might not even have noticed, but I'm used to watching other people's body language, and I know Martin back to front. The moment I said the name Owen Andrews, it was as if someone had suddenly switched a light on inside him, then just as rapidly flicked it off again. Something he didn't want to talk about, or felt uncertain of. Could have been either. I'd been telling him about my research, my various theories about Irene Wilbur. I'd deliberately held off mentioning Arthur Rawlin, because once you get Martin onto the subject of watches, it's difficult to get him off it again. I knew he'd be interested, but the extremity of his reaction surprised me all the same. "I've heard of him, yes," Martin said finally. "But what does he have to do with Irene Wilbur?" This is going to sound strange, but I decided more or less in that moment that I wasn't going to tell Martin I had Rawlin's watch in my possession. Not yet, anyway. It wasn't that I didn't trust him. I would trust Martin with my life, and perhaps that was the problem. It was as if, and I know how bizarre this sounds, especially coming from an unreconstructed rationalist like me, I sensed already that something was going to happen. Something involving the watch. I think I was afraid that if Martin got wind of what I meant to do, he would say it was dangerous and try to stop me. I'm not good at taking advice. Once I have a mind to do something, you might as well try advising a stampeding mare with a swarm of bees on her tail. No one knows this better than Martin, and normally he'd stay out of it. But in this case, let's just say I wanted to keep my intentions under wraps. "Nothing," I said. "At least nothing directly." I told him about Arthur Rawlin and Arthur Rawlin's posthumous obsession with Helen Bostel, and then added that my old client, Lewis Usher, knew someone who knew someone who'd purchased Arthur Rawlin's watch in a private auction. "It's by a London maker, apparently, this Owen Andrews," I said. "Lewis seems to think that Rawlin attached mystical properties to the watch, that he believed it could reverse time or something. He's going to try and dig out the documents for me. Lewis, I mean. I wondered if you knew anything about this Andrews guy, that's all." "Only that he trained in Southwark, and that his watches are vanishingly rare," Martin said. He sighed. There are entire internet forums devoted to Owen Andrews. He's one of those people other people are always talking about, probably because we know so little about him. People are still having arguments over exactly when he was born. There's speculation that he had access to Breguet's late notebooks. I don't believe it myself. I don't see how he could have done. The notebooks weren't in the public domain for at least a century after Breguet's death. Who's Breguet? Abraham Louis Breguet, a Swiss watchmaker. He's best known for making a watch for Marie Antoinette and almost losing his head for his trouble. But for horologists, Breguet is most famous for inventing the tourbillon. Martin went off into a long-winded explanation of what a tourbillon was and how it worked. How, before Breguet, no pocket watch could keep accurate time over a long period because of gravity, which acted as a drag weight on the mechanism, speeding it up or slowing it down by as much as 60 seconds in every hour. Breguet placed the whole mechanism inside a revolving metal cage he called a tourbillon, or whirlwind. The tourbillon kept the mechanism in stasis, twirling it around its own axis, like a sidecar on a fairground ride. The tourbillon watch was like a planet spinning in space. In every sense that mattered, it was weightless. Think of a tornado, Martin said. A wind itself has no substance, but it has incredible power. It renders everything weightless before it, even massive objects like houses and cars. I zoned out a bit towards the end, not because what Martin was telling me wasn't interesting, but because I couldn't see how any of it related to Arthur Rawlin and a possible time machine. Then Martin said something else, something jaw-dropping. I was dragged back into the conversation with a physical jolt. What was that about the notebooks? Breguet's notebooks, Martin repeated. His doctors always insisted he was senile by then, but according to his son, Breguet was lucid and rational right up until he died. His late writings suggest he had been trying to create a kind of super tourbillon, a mechanism he believed would eventually enable human beings to travel through time. He called it the time stasis. I can't believe anyone would take it literally, quite honestly, but some of the people on the forums believe Owen Andrews made it his mission to put Breguet's theory into practice. To make a watch that could turn back time. Martin shrugged, if you like. That's incredible. If it were true, maybe. But I've seen some of Andrews' pieces and they're just watches. Andrews was gifted, but he wasn't a magician. All that time travel stuff, it's just the horological equivalent of urban myth. I thought there was something heroic about it nonetheless. The lone mechanic, pitting himself against logic like a gladiator fighting a tiger. I reminded myself that all the most radical advances in science seem like lunacy before they are proven. It's a beautiful word, I said to Martin. Horological. Are you still convinced Helen Bostel was innocent? He asked. More than ever. And I believe Arthur Rawlin thought so too. That's why he felt so guilty over her death. You're determined to prove it, aren't you? Through your book. I laughed. I suppose I am. I didn't just want to prove it, though. I can admit that now. I wanted to change it. But I wasn't about to blow my cover to Martin. 3 days later, I performed an experiment. Just one little trip back, 5 minutes or so. Brain of Britain was on the radio, which made it easy to tell if anything had actually happened. I had a second go at some of the questions, which would have upped my score if I'd been keeping tally, which I wasn't. It would have been cheating anyway. Jocelyn Bell turned out to be Jocelyn Leslie, an artist. She won a scholarship to study at the Slade, and when her father, a successful Yorkshire businessman of a conservative cast of mind, refused to let her go, she continued to paint in secret, making her own way to London 2 years later. She enjoyed moderate popularity for a time, although there were those who dismissed her efforts as primitive or naive. Lavinia Sable, who wrote art criticism for several London papers under the pseudonym Marcus Fell, insisted that in spite of having almost no formal training, Bell's work showed a keener understanding of European modernism than many of her better-known contemporaries. I liked the sound of Lavinia, who apparently attended private views and press gatherings for years as Marcus, with no one being any the wiser. Lavinia was easily interesting enough to fill a book in her own right. But Lavinia was not my mission, and after spending a day or two reading up on her, I laid the material reluctantly aside and went back to the matter in hand, namely Jocelyn Bell. On arrival in London, Jocelyn found work first as an assistant housekeeper at a private boarding school for girls, then as a secretary and assistant to the curator of one of the more progressive galleries on Cork Street. It was here, I'm certain, that she first encountered Leonard Bell, who was friendly with several of the artists represented there. Leonard Bell was actually Leonid Balayev, a Russian émigré and a member of the radical socialist group based in Camden called the Four Brothers. The group was founded in the 1890s, and unlike many similar loose associations that fractured and splintered at the outbreak of war, the Four Brothers remained intact as a group well into the 1920s. At some point during 1924, Edward Dillon began attending their meetings. Here, at last, was the breakthrough I'd been searching for. Jocelyn Leslie married Leonard Bell in 1902. They had one son, Malcolm, in 1903, although letters sent by Jocelyn to a friend in Manchester reveal that differences were already making themselves felt between the couple, and by 1905 their marriage was over in all but name. Leonard Bell kept in close touch with his family, though I think he was probably still living under the same roof for some years after he and Jocelyn separated, a fact that would almost certainly have led to gossip amongst the neighbours. Not that Jocelyn or Leonard gave much of a damn for bourgeois convention. They remained friends, and when Leonard eventually began a long-term affair with another woman, the woman quickly became Jocelyn's friend also. That woman, and you can imagine my satisfaction when I was able to prove this for sure, was Irene Wilbur. There were, in fact, several dozen letters from Leonard to his lover, preserved amongst Jocelyn Bell's papers at the Women Artists Forum in Hammersmith. As a bonus, the letters also revealed to me the identity of Malcolm Bell's soon-to-be fiancée, Louise Titchener. Frustratingly, I was never able to find out much about Irene Wilbur herself, and I can only assume her willingness to go along with the murder plot had more to do with her wanting to protect Leonard Bell than with any active animosity towards Helen Bostel. The true identity of Dillon's murderer also remained hidden from me, although I'm more or less positive it wasn't Bell himself. Leonard was a hardened activist. He would have known better than to put himself directly at risk. After weeks of rooting around in various archives of obscure research papers, I came to the conclusion that the most likely suspect was a much younger man, Michael Woolcott, who seems to have known Dylan when he was living in Manchester. The two had some sort of falling out, either in Manchester or soon after Woolcott's own arrival in the capital. So far as I know, they were never reconciled, although mysteriously there was one final meeting between them in a Camden public house, just 10 days before Dylan's murder. The meeting was remarked upon by a moderate socialist named West, a journalist who wrote a satirical column for an independent newspaper called The Masthead, lampooning many of the personalities associated with the more extreme wing of the movement. They say that if you sup with the devil, you should use a long spoon, West wrote in his January 20th column, just 1 week before the murder. Judging by the outbreak of cozy camaraderie at the Horse's Head last Thursday evening, it would seem there are those who set little store by such sage advice, even those we might consider our elders and betters. West goes on to reveal the identities of both Dylan and Woolcott, referring to the latter as an upwardly mobile cur of the Belayef persuasion, and to the meeting itself as a council of war. Which can only beg the question, West writes, of who exactly is at war here, and with whom. Whether the police were ever made aware of West's column or possessed enough insider knowledge to make head or tail of it, I have no idea. Leonard Bell was questioned briefly along with 24 or so other regular and irregular members of the Four Brothers group, though the comrades' universal disdain for the official forces of law and order would have meant the chances of anyone letting anything slip were practically nil. Helen Bostel's ticket for the boat train was forward dated to February 3rd. A date that turned out to be less than a week after Dylan's murder. It seems likely that someone friendly with Leonard Bell or one of his cronies, knew about Helen's travel plans. For Bell's plan to succeed, it was crucial that Dylan be killed well in advance of Helen's departure for the continent. I believe it was Dylan's meeting with Woolcott, staged by Bell as an opportunity for reconciliation, that set the stage for the murder. No doubt Woolcott had been instructed to arrange a second, more informal meeting to take place at Dylan's flat. Putting all the evidence together, it finally became clear to me that it was those 10 days that formed the crucial time period, the 10 days between Dylan first meeting Woolcott at the Horse's Head and his eventual death. If Helen Bostel could have been persuaded to bring her journey forward, to leave London soon after New Year, say, then Bell would either have had to shelve his plans or risk being exposed as complicit in Dylan's killing. Regardless of Dylan's fate, Helen Bostel herself would have been saved. If only someone could have told her, I thought, and almost immediately afterwards I thought of Arthur Rawlin. Had he tried to use the watch? I wondered. If so, he had obviously failed. As to why Bell wanted Dylan dead in the first place, the reasons remained obscure to me. All I could think was that it must have been down to some intricate power struggle within the Four Brothers. Truth be told, I didn't care much. Not then. I knew from the start that the best place to approach Helen would be at one of her suffragist meetings. The very nature of such gatherings meant there would always be new faces in evidence, strangers who might turn up for a couple of meetings and then disappear again. It ought to be relatively easy to mingle with the women without drawing undue attention to myself. The main thing was not to go overboard in trying to fit in. I chose clothes that were unobtrusive rather than authentic. The three-quarter-length coat I normally wore to court hearings in winter, a dark paisley-pattern skirt I hardly ever wore but couldn't bear to throw out because I liked the material so much, a pair of black lace-up shoes. Plain clothes in every sense of the word. By now, you're either wondering what on earth I'm talking about or if I can possibly be serious. Which is fine. I kept putting off the actual journey. I told myself I needed to do more research, which was at least partly true. To keep myself safe, I had to know that particular bit of Camden well enough to be able to walk around it blindfold, if need be. But mostly, I was just scared. Scared in case the watch didn't work, and scared in case it did. 5 minutes and 100 years were not the same thing. What if the watch refused to bring me back, or marooned me in a time that was not my own? I wanted to know, though. I wanted to see. The closer it came to the date I'd set myself, the more impatient I felt, impatient with my fear, impatient with my delaying tactics. When Ray phoned me the night before to ask me if I was going to some private view or other his agent was organising, I almost bit his head off. "Are you okay, Dottie?" he said. He hadn't called me Dottie for years, not since we separated. "I'll be there. Don't worry," I said, not answering his question and not knowing if I'd be there either. "I've got a lot on at work, that's all. Say hi to Cleo for me." Cleo is Ray's daughter, the child he has with Maya. I should make more of an effort with Maya, I suppose, but it's difficult. We're such different people, and although chumming up with her ex-husband's new wife seemed to work for Jocelyn Bell, I'm not sure it's for me. Cleo, though. She's 8 years old and a miracle. I could never tell this to anyone, not even Martin, but occasionally it breaks my heart that she isn't mine. There is a lever inside the watch, a silver pin that slides from side to side inside a moulded slit. Imagine the back of an old wind-up alarm clock, the little lever you use to engage the alarm function, or to turn it off. There is no clear indication of what the purpose of this lever might be, and when you first engage it, nothing seems to happen. Say, nothing happens full stop, if you like. I won't mind. I once had a conversation with Martin years ago when we were kids about whether ghosts existed. When I asked Martin if he believed, he said it didn't matter. If ghosts exist, they'll go on existing whether we believe in them or not. It's the same with this. And if I tell you that what time travel reminds me of most of all is the time before my illness, I wonder, will you believe that either? The time when I was so in love with numbers, when I could listen to numbers conversing the same way you might listen to music, when I felt the thrum of numbers in my blood, intricate as a crystal lattice, sound and rhythmic and basic as the beat of a drum. I turned the lever, and the rush of numbers filled my head, blazing in my veins like alcohol, like burning petrol. The music of the primes, Du Sautoir called it. And I could hear it again. I closed my eyes and counted backwards. I could feel the boundaries of reality expanding, unfurling. bobbing deftly out of reach of my hands like a toy balloon. I ducked under the boundary wire and followed. Time filled me up, chilly and intoxicating. Yes, but what's it like? I can hear you asking. Like a triple slug of Russian vodka that's been kept in the icebox, that's what it's like. I started going on practice runs. Just silly things, walking past my front door in the middle of last week, going to a concert at the Barbican I'd wanted to attend when it was actually on but happened to miss. I thought that getting the timing right would prove difficult, but in fact the mechanism was extremely accurate once you got the hang of it. I found it mostly came down to imagining, knowing where you wanted to be and forming an image of the place and time inside your mind. This sounds irrational, I know, but that's how it was. I spent a lot of time in Camden, just walking around. You'd be surprised how little it's changed. Even when houses, whole streets have been torn down and built over, the old shadows remain. The city has a shape. You can sense it if you feel for it, even if you're sleepwalking, and perhaps especially then. London's presence wrapped closely around you like a blanket. The suffragist meetings took place in rooms about the Quaker Meeting House on Bentley Street. During the day it was mostly quiet, but in the evenings things livened up considerably, mainly because of the Charlady, a public house and pie shop on the corner of the street opposite. I went in daylight the first time, just to be safe. Muggings were common then in this part of London, and I saw no point in exposing myself to unnecessary risk. You think of the past as cleaner, but it really isn't. Horseshit, engine oil, smoke, blood, piss, beer, the rotting detritus from the market, piled at the curb. Not London as it might be in a theme park, but a London you'd recognise instantly just from the stench. Cars are creeping in already. Hackney cabs and omnibuses. Gentlemen's conveyances. And the bikes. The thrilling tring of bicycle bells. Boy couriers speeding along. Oi, miss, get on the pavement, why don't you? Bleeding heck! A flower and matchbox seller, a puckered scar across one cheek and her left hand missing. I reach into my pocket to find the right coins, then remember I don't have the right coins. Not at all. Exactly the kind of stupid blunder I'm supposed to be on guard against. The peddler gazes at me with tired eyes, and I look away in shame. The next time I come, I bring her a paper packet of corned beef sandwiches, but she is no longer there. Not in the same place, anyway. I remind myself of what I'm here for and move swiftly along. Another time, I stand in a shop doorway opposite and watch the women arrive for their meeting. I'm amazed to find that I recognize some of them from the letters I've read, from the blurred photographs in the Women's Studies archive in the British Library. One of them, a young poet named Kathleen Thwaite, is accompanied to the door of the meeting house by her husband, Austin Gears. I know that Kathleen is to die in 1937 on a protest march against Franco's fascists in Madrid. It makes my heart ache to see her, and the urge to do something, to warn her in some way, is all but overwhelming. I turn quickly away, hoping to catch a glimpse of Helen Bostel instead. On this occasion, at least, she appears to be absent. Has my being here, even to stand motionless in the street, altered things somehow, and for the worse? I push the thought away. It is coincidence, that's all. She will be here next week, and if not then, the week after. It need not matter. The next time, I file inside the hall with the other women. No one talks to me or takes particular notice, but many smile. I feel accepted as one of them. More than that, I can imagine myself as one of them. Almost as if I have experienced this life, this version of my life anyway, this Dora Newland who attended suffragist rallies in Hyde Park, who conducted furious arguments with her uncle about being allowed to travel down through Italy with another woman friend. Casting Henry, dear Henry, who indulged our every whim when we were children, in the role of domineering guardian makes me smile. We sit on hard wooden chairs in the draughty space, three small attic rooms that have been converted into one larger one, and listen to a Mrs. Marjorie Hennessy tell us about her experience of studying politics at the Sorbonne. She is an impressive woman, commanding and authoritative, and I cannot help wondering what happened to her. How come she failed? So many women. It is depressing to consider how many of us have been discouraged, disparaged, forced to reconsider, turned aside from our dreams. I want to rush up to Marjorie Hennessy and tell her not to give up, not to drop by the wayside, not to fall silent. She's wonderful, isn't she? It is the interval, and we are queuing up for tea. The woman who speaks to me seems shy and rather young, and I have the feeling this is her first time here also. Her cheeks are flushed pink. Admirable, I say. And for a second I experience a sensation close to vertigo. I am here, and I am speaking to someone. I hug my bag, as if seeking support from it. Inside the bag are the keys to my flat, my purse, my Kindle e-reader, my mobile phone, all those other insignificant trifles that don't exist yet. I come from the future, I think, in what Martin always calls the MGM voice. I want to laugh out loud. I glance over at the chalkboard where Marjorie Hennessy has been drawing diagrams illustrating the economic implications of women withdrawing their labour from the home. I wonder how my new friend in the tea queue would react if I were to tell her that almost a century later we're still fighting the same battles. Again, I want to laugh. Not that it's funny. We need more like her, I say instead, because that also is still true. Now, more than ever, we need more anger, more knowledge. Shall we sit down? We take our tea and sit at one of the wooden trestles at the side of the hall. The woman tells me her name is Barbara Winton, and she's a socialist. They say there's going to be another war, she says. We have to join with our sisters in Europe. We must prevent war at all costs. She is learning German and corresponding with the daughter of a friend of her father's who lives in Frankfurt. Her name is Gisela. She's a sculptor. Don't you think that's marvellous? She's asked me to go out and visit her, and Daddy says I can. It feels, I'm not sure how to explain, as if a whole new life is beginning. I hope you're right, I say. I tell her that I'm studying law, that I'm hoping to practice at the bar. I see confusion on her face, my age probably, which is swiftly succeeded by a kind of wonder mixed with mischievous delight. Women have been allowed access to the legal profession for less than a decade, after all. Well done, you, she says. I think that's marvellous. Her excitement is contagious. It is only as we are about to resume our seats for the second half of the programme that I finally catch sight of Helen Bostel. She is near the back of the room talking to a woman with an upright posture and hawkish nose whom I recognise at once as Daphne Evans. I gaze at them, dumbstruck. I feel like a spy. As I move towards my seat, I see Helen turn just for a moment and look directly at me. Instead of the blank, flat gaze of a woman casually scanning the crowd, what I see in her eyes, indisputably, is recognition. You're here. I feel cold right through. My hands begin to shake. I'm going to drop my cup, I think, then realize it's all right. I no longer have it. Barbara Winton has taken it from me and returned it to the tea bench at the back. That was when I lost my nerve. Instead of sitting down again, I pushed through the crowd to the door and then rushed down the stairs, almost tripping over the paisley skirt in the process. Once outside, I felt better. There was the usual rowdy hubbub coming from the charlady, the same stink of greasy Irish stew and overloaded dustbins. I made my way to an access lane between two rows of terraces and took out the watch. I engaged the lever without looking at it. Not looking had become a kind of superstition with me, and stood there in the dark, counting primes and feeling that odd, trembling dream state take hold until I became aware of the sound of traffic. Motor traffic, I mean. Buses and police sirens on Camden High Street. I was back. I breathed in through my mouth, tasting exhaust fumes and the tarry scent of someone's spent cigarette. I stood still for some moments, letting the world come back into focus around me and feeling the relief I felt each time, that I had conducted an extremely risky experiment, heating flash powder in a petri dish, say, and managed to get away without blowing my hands off. I never experimented with going forward, not even by one day. I had a terror of it. A paralyzing phobia. It was a deal I made, I suppose, with God, the devil, myself, Owen Andrews. Bring me safely home and I'll keep our bargain. Well, I guess it worked. The next time I went back, I was prepared. So, it seems, was Helen. She was waiting for me this time at the bottom of the stairs outside the meeting house. She told me later that she'd waited there at the start of every meeting since she'd first seen me, knowing I would be returning but not knowing when. "Dora," she said quietly, "you're here at last." She caught my hands in both of hers. Her fingers were cold. It was December, and she was smiling in a way that suggested she was greeting an old friend, someone she knew well but hadn't seen in a while. Pleasure and sadness, as if she knew our time together would not be long. "I don't understand," I said, and sighed. Who was I to talk? How did you know me? "Knowing everything you know, do you need to ask?" she said. "The order in which things happen doesn't matter, surely. Just that they happen. I'm so pleased to see you." She leaned forward to embrace me, and I found myself almost believing. There was such joy in seeing her, such emotion, that this was indeed a reunion, and not, as I knew it to be, our first meeting. "Come," she said, "we can go back to the flat. Edwin's away, in Manchester. That's what he says, anyway." "You don't think he really is?" She shrugged. "Edwin tells me what it pleases him to tell me. Sometimes it's the truth, and sometimes it isn't. I had to give up caring which a long time ago." We came to Milliver Road. I'd been to the house, of course. What I mean is, I'd stood outside it many times. I knew 112 as a spruce, bay-fronted terrace with replacement windows. The house in Helen's time seemed smaller, meaner. The exterior paintwork chipped and blistering. A flight of steps led steeply down to a basement forecourt. "We've had problems with damp," Helen said. "The woman who lives upstairs says there are rats too, but I've never seen them." "Mrs. Wilbur?" She gave me a puzzled look. "Mrs. Wilbur?" "Mrs. Herschel lives on the ground floor. There's no Mrs. Wilbur." "It doesn't matter," I said. So my researches had proved correct. Irene Wilbur hadn't moved in yet. There was still time. "Let's go in and get warm," Helen said. "I'll light the stove." "We were happy here once, Edwin and I," Helen said. The stove was well alight. Soft lamplight threw shadows on the whitewashed walls of the cosy front sitting room. Framed prints showing images from a Greek bestiary. An orange and green Aubusson rug. Books. Books everywhere. Overflowing the alcove shelving and piled on the floor. A stack of handwritten pages lay fanned across a low wooden table. It was a good room, a room I felt at home in. I also knew I'd been here before. "Have you eaten?" Helen asked. I laughed. "It's been 100 years at least," I said. "I can warm up some soup. I made it yesterday." "That would be lovely." I wasn't hungry, quite the opposite, but I was curious to see how food might taste here. In fact, it tasted like potato soup, thick and nutritious and well-seasoned. We ate, dipping bread into our bowls, and I asked Helen what she was working on. "I've been helping to edit a collection of essays by women on the subject of war," she said. "I want to include writing by German women as well. Letters, memoir, whatever I can get hold of." The publisher was against this at first, but I managed to persuade them how important it is, essential even. "You don't think it's too soon?" I shook my head. "I'm glad. We have to use every weapon we have."
"Weapon?"
"To make people understand what war really is, the madness of it." She fell silent, head bent. "Dora, I know I shouldn't really ask you this, but do we succeed? Do we succeed at all?" I know I shouldn't answer, and I don't, not then. But the following week, when I know that Helen will be at her meeting, I return to Milliver Road for one final visit. I have an envelope with me addressed to Helen. I post it through the front door of the house, hear it fall onto the scuffed brown linoleum of the communal hallway. Inside is a second-hand copy of John Hirst's memoir Hiroshima in the original Pelican edition, its pages faded and brittle but clearly readable, the most concise response to her question that I can think of. What good will it do? None at all. But Helen asked me a question, and she deserves an answer. "That doesn't matter now," I said in 1927. "What I mean is, it matters, but there are more urgent things to think about, urgent for you, anyway."
"You're frightening me."
"In a month's time, Edwin is going to be murdered. If you stay here, you are going to be blamed for it. There will be a trial and..."
"You're telling me I'm going to be hanged for a crime I had nothing to do with?"
I stared at her, horrified.
"I thought it was a dream," she said more quietly. "That man. He sat on the edge of my bed and told me about it. He was crying. He seemed quite mad. When I told him to go away, he did. I wish I'd been kinder."
Arthur Rawlin. So he had used the watch to try and save her after all.
"None of that is going to happen," I said quickly. But you must leave London and Edwin. You need to pack your things and get as far away from here as you can. She nodded slowly. I've been planning to go anyway. To leave Edwin, I mean. Whatever we had, it's over. I could say he's changed, but really I think it's me. I see him differently now. She paused. I see everything differently. Can you think of any reason why anyone would want to kill Edwin? She was silent for a long time, lacing and unlacing her fingers. Finally, she sighed. I really don't involve myself with Edwin's business anymore, but I do know there are people in the Four Brothers he's fallen out with. Badly. Edwin believes, I don't know, that we should do something to signal the start of the revolution. Something dramatic, something violent even. He says he has people standing by. Bomb makers. She shook her head. I don't know how much of this is true and how much is just talk. The more he drinks, the more he talks, Edwin. That's something I've noticed. Not that half the brethren would see much wrong if Edwin really is planning to blow people up. I think mainly it's about power within the group. Who has it and who doesn't? There are some who see Edwin as a threat, who think he's getting above himself. I'm sure they'd be more than happy if he were out of the way. Can you believe that? I can more than believe that. They don't like him because he's clever, because he doesn't give two hoots about their old hierarchies, because he's from Manchester, even. She turned to look at me. I keep asking myself if it's partly my fault that things have gone this far. If I could have talked to him more, maybe. But I've come to understand that Edwin never cared about what I thought, not even at the beginning. He wanted an audience, that's all. Now that I no longer listen, he cares even less. I was tempted to tell her about Ray and me, but decided that would be unfair. Ray's no bomb maker, just another man with an ego who needs it stroking. Now that I no longer have to live with him, I can even enjoy his company from time to time. Where will you go? I said instead. I have a friend, Elsa Erling, in Berlin. She says I can stay with her as long as I need. I can teach English, and there are other things I can do to make myself useful. Elsa says workers for peace need to make their voices heard in Germany now more than ever. You'd be right there, I thought, but did not say. I'd interfered enough already. Besides, she would be safe in Berlin, at least for a time. I would wait until the new year, but not much longer, I said, and tell no one what you are planning, not even Daphne. You can write to her from Berlin, she will understand. I know she will. And Dora, thank you. We talked of other things then, the book she dreamed of writing on poetry and war, my love of numbers and the loneliness I'd always felt in having to abandon them. But you never did abandon them. Your being here is proof. You can see that, surely. She was right in a way, I suppose. But I'm no Sophie Germain. The stove gave out its warmth. And we sat beside it. I understood that this was the moment of change, that if I had indeed met with Helen before, I would not do so again, that I had done what I had come to do, and that this was goodbye. I felt time tremble in the balance, then come to a standstill. There are moments when time lies in stasis, and this was one of them. But time always moves on. I'm pregnant, by the way, Helen said as I was leaving. Edwin doesn't know. Don't worry. My heart leapt up at her words. I think I knew this was your story even then. Edwin Dillon lived. With Helen gone and his plans in ruins, Leonard Bell must have decided that murdering him was too much of a risk. Or perhaps he waited, hoping for a better opportunity and never finding it. A year later, the four brothers disbanded. Leonard Bell went to Germany, where he became part of the communist movement dedicated to getting rid of Adolf Hitler. He was arrested and deported back to London in 1934. Edwin Dillon headed a splinter group, also calling itself the Four Brothers, and believed to be one of the main instigators of the notorious plot to assassinate Oswald Mosley in 1936. He served 4 years for his involvement, and although it is not known whether it was prison that made him lose his appetite for radical politics, he cut loose from all his four brothers' contacts and after the war returned to working as a freelance journalist. You can find feature articles by Edwin Dillon in the archives of The Times, The Guardian and the Glasgow Herald, among other places. He died in 1971. He was briefly involved with the Irish writer Ina Mowbray, with whom he had one son. Douglas Mowbray also worked as a journalist and was known to be a fervent supporter of the IRA. Douglas died, aged 31, when he killed himself and his young daughter Gemma by driving off a bridge on the outskirts of Belfast. His son, Purik, who was also in the car at the time, survived. I have been unable to trace his whereabouts. There is every possibility that he is still alive. Real history is a mass of conflicting stories. According to the official records, Helen Mildred Bostel was tried and found guilty of the murder of Edwin Patrick Dillon and was sentenced to death. The execution was carried out on August 14th, 1928. History seems content with this judgment, though there are many, including myself, who would argue that capital punishment is never justified. There are also anomalies, if you care to look for them. The Library of the Sorbonne records the publication in 1941 of a pamphlet by Ellen Tuglass with the title On War, The Imaginary Reminiscences of Hell's Survivor. The work was originally written in English, although a French translation was provided by Ivan Tuglass, a Russian exile resident in Paris since the 1920s, and Ellen's common law husband until his death in 1952. On War is a peculiar work. Lodged halfway between fact and fiction, it has aroused some interest among scholars of World War II literature because it appears to predict the nuclear destruction of Hiroshima. I remember where I was when they told me, states the unnamed narrator. I have never before felt able to speak my feelings aloud, but what I wanted when I heard was simply to be there. To be not guilty of this thing, to help one person up from the rubble, even if such an action brought about my own destruction. I yearned to haul myself across bleeding Europe with my coat in tatters and no money in my purse. You will say that these feelings were selfish, and I would not blame you for saying so. Some crimes are so huge, there can be no recompense. On War is dedicated to Ellen's daughter, Isabel Elsa, who was 11 years old at the time of its publication. I knew Ray's mother was called Isabel, but she was old and living in Paris, and I never met her. She died 3 years ago. I know that Ray sent her photos of you when you were born. I imagine they were there beside her bed on the day she died. Ray was always meaning to take you over there so she could get to know you. It's too late now, but that's Ray all over. He loses track of time. Dearest Cleo, We can only cheat time for so long. And I knew when I went back to Milliver Street that final time it should be the last. Your great-grandmother, though, Ellen Tooglas, whose name was once Helen Bostel. I should have guessed she would find a means of letting me know our escape plan succeeded, and that her name would be Cleo. Cleo, the daughter of memory, the muse of history. I should have known that through you, Cleo, Helen and I would one day meet again. I carried on writing the book, of course I did, my account of Helen Bostel and how she was hanged for a crime she didn't commit. I'd come so far with my research I didn't feel like giving up. And as a story, as I say, it had everything. Bomb plots, political feuding, affairs of the heart, as many double crosses as you might find in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. My editor at History Recollected even thinks she's found a publisher for it. I doubt it'll make me rich, but it should do all right. You can read the book when you're older. Make of it what you will. Godmothers can be boring, can't they? Especially godmothers who also happen to be lawyers. At least you can tell yourself that your boring lawyer godmother once changed the world. A little bit, anyway. I don't imagine you'll be telling anyone else.